I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. So the door has closed in 2020. Thank goodness.
Yeah, hallelujah.
It's our first episode of the new year. Hello, 2021.
Woohoo!
This year, we want to bring you even more inspiring guests and near dears that can bring us all closer to a future of universal well-being for people and planet. And we're kicking it all off with Rebecca Adamson.
Rebecca Adamson is an American Cherokee economist, an activist who has dedicated her life to the study and advancement of indigenous economies. In a world dominated by extraction, accumulation, and competition, Rebecca offers insight into another way of organizing society, built around the values of harmony with nature, subsistence, and balance.
Whatever comes this year, we hope you'll be sparked by some of the lessons Rebecca shares.
Well, I'm Rebecca Adamson. I guess if we were to string some titles after my name, I would be glad to claim and hope to fulfill being an Indigenous economist and always, first and foremost, an activist of Cherokee descent coming from North Carolina. I wasn't raised traditionally, but I did have exposure and experience with the brilliant paradigms that are the foundation of how we solve our own social, economic, and political problems. Because I believe every society, every single society, organizes itself socially, politically, and economically according to its values. And as I was growing up, I grew up in a culture that, first of all, prized women's leadership. We were assumed to be leaders by the mere fact we were women. And our role was to bring feminine-female power in balance for the universe and for the world. Our power was very important. And so that balance and that harmony needs to be brought to the forefront. And my hopes and dreams or calling, I guess, is been about bringing the indigenous brilliance and those paradigms and harnessing them for contemporary application. And most of my life's work has been around looking at economics and prosperity within a lens of being a Native community and how so many of our values aren't within today's economics. So that while we could feel we're successful because we have this gorgeous, gorgeous land with these beautiful trees, in the economy, we don't have anything because they haven't been cut down and sent to the market. So it was really wrestling with all of that, having the experience of my values and understanding of my communities and going out into a world that didn't even recognize us, let alone understand those underpinnings, the philosophies and the paradigms behind our societies.
In the intro, Rebecca, you said you're an indigenous economist. And what exactly is indigenous economy?
In technical terms, I suppose we would call it like a subsistence or barter trade economy. If you look at a command controlled and a market based, you look at a barter trade economy. The fascinating thing about our economy is, again, the values, the fundamental purpose of organizing our economy was sustainability and to meet the needs of the most people possible. So we wanted to meet all of the needs for all of the people that we could. It's a very different goal than accumulation. And I think you have to back up to the paradigms to understand how different it is. In today's economy that we're living in, the paradigm behind that is scarcity of resources and individual insatiable appetites. Now, that's a belief system in that paradigm. And it's organized as a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've got this individuation for the aggregate of individuals. Well, you aggregate the individuals doesn't mean the common good is realized. You are looking always out of fear at scarcity of resources. So what gets rewarded is competition and accumulation. Those are the values most sacred in this society and this organization of an economy. If you come over to the paradigm with indigenous peoples, it's prosperity of creation and a kinship-based sense of enoughness. I'll put a little plug in here. If you go to YouTube and go into the YouTube channel and you type in enoughness and you look for First Peoples Worldwide, I did about a 4.5-minute cartoon or animation on really understanding enoughness from this lens of a paradigm that's really looking at a belief in prosperity of creation. Sure, we might run out of fossil fuel, but we can create solar. We can create wind. That creative force is manifested in the universe, in all aspects of the universe, if you're open to that. And that creative force realizes abundance in balance with harmony. The part of it is, if you look at that kinship-based sense of enoughness, what you have in the economy are very clear, sophisticated channels of redistribution. And a people who have the values of understanding, I call it enoughness, but you take what you need and you give back, so that that kind of economy is organized, again, with the primary and fundamental purpose of meeting the most needs for the most people. It's hard to explain when not doing it visual, but we mapped, the University of Alaska Sociology Department was the technical brilliance behind this, but we mapped an Alaskan village, and we mapped all of the places that a whale harvest would be shared. So if you think of whales as wealth in our communities, that's probably the difference. Is it abstractly, the whale represents wealth to us, the same way money would represent wealth to today's downtown or city. If you look at the way that wealth in the whale was, once it's harvested, how it's distributed, I sent you a graphic of it. Would you mind trying to describe it to our listeners as to how many places that whale meat is distributed? Because I have a map on cash, and I want you to talk about both of those maps. But first, how much distribution do you see in that whale network?
Well, the whale map shows, it looks like little houses in a village. So it's a bunch of dots. And the whale map shows almost every dot connected to every other dot. So there's a lot of connected, a very dense network. I don't know. It looks like about 100, but
I think a little bit less. Maybe, 50 maybe.
But what's remarkable about this map isn't the number of nodes on the network. It's how densely connected that network is. It's like, it looks like a brain map.
Wow, that's a good, yes.
Yeah, and it's like the center is even more connected than the dots.
And that's the purpose behind our economy, is those connections. We believe we are connected to everyone, and everyone, it's that, all is family, all are related. And that is reflected in how we designed the economy. Now the cash one.
So the cash one has the same number of nodes, but the connections are way sparser. Maybe 10 of the nodes have connections with other nodes.
So it actually looks pretty white.
This looks like a bunch of dots with a few lines.
It's jaw-dropping when you can visually see how much weight is given to the goal of genuinely reaching everyone possible and reaching for as many needs as we can meet in the way the economy is designed. There's actually four key parts to a subsistence economy. I think the name itself kind of brings to vision just barely eking out your life. Oh, you're barely subsisting. Subsistence was vibrant, robust, resilient, and rich. And the four pieces we had was, one, first, community was essential. Everybody owned community. Nobody could sell community. We were all a part of community, and we had rights. The minute you're born, you have hunting camps, fishing camps, gathering areas that by right, you have those usage to those areas. So that community is first and foremost the preservation. The purpose of the economy is to preserve and maintain that community sense. And it's essential, seen as essential for our survival. The second part of our economy is we understand nature as the source of our knowledge. We learn from nature in a way that we harvest when it's the best time to harvest, when the fish are the most plentiful, when they're the richest and healthiest. It's a completely different than maximum yield. It's really an understanding of a measured harvest according to natural laws by years and years of watching nature and looking at not an average take, not a maximum yield, but what makes the most sense. And a lot of times entire areas would be put off in what an anthropologist might call taboo, but those were replenishing times. They were very deliberate conservation technology in use around replenishing the territories. The third principle is really the subsistence's interplay with spirituality. We never believed we were going out and going to catch a fish. We believed that the fish or the bison gave its life to us to sustain us. So there was tremendous respect in the harvesting and production side of the economy, in that you recognized you did not waste. I think, what is it? We waste 40% of the animal life that we kill in our commercial factories now. So that 40% of the death of the pigs and the goats and the cows are going to be wasted anyway. We would never have that kind of waste because of the spiritual values in play with both the production and the consumption side. And the fourth is the cultural component. Our cultures, the way our family units and extended families were organized, were kind of the production system to our economy, so that you had production and kinship and flexible and decentralized kinship networks. So small groups of families would do a lot of the production, but probably the six main pieces were: we were a mixed economy that was mutually supportive of the market and of subsistence. We had a domestic mode of production where capital, land, and labor were units controlled by the kinship, community-based decision production units. We had established seasonal rounds of production, harvesting when it was the best time to harvest and the least invasive for the species or the plant, be it plant or animal. We had networks of sharing and distribution, just like I showed in the whale maps. Those were vibrant networks on the distribution. We had more sophisticated distribution mechanisms than they have nowadays in this economy. And we had very traditional regimes of land use and occupancy. It was a complex system of beliefs and knowledge and values that drove, to be a leader and to be respected, you actually shared, and it was what you could give away, not what you could accumulate. And if we have to, can I tell you a contemporary story sort of where these exact same principles are being applied?
Sure, of course.
Because a lot of times I will talk about this and people say, oh, you're being romantic. You know, it can't happen in today's economy. It has to be quaint little houses in a community. But this story in particular, it starts in 1968. And it was an entire industry that was on the verge of collapse. Now, in 1968, losing $1 million a day was a lot. And that's where this industry was. It was characterized by a sheer vicious competition with a lot of dominance of a few major players. But by and large, this dominance could only go so far because they wanted to expand what they were doing. And it was an industry that actually could not sustain itself the way it was operating. So a man got assigned with figuring this out and how was he going to go. And he basically actually says that he borrowed from an indigenous economy. But the principles he used were: community is essential. The entity can be owned, but it cannot be bought and sold. All ownership and financing is equitable. Equity and justice must be maintained within and among every member. So there was no intrinsic value allowed to be a big player who dominates it. Cooperation was key. The production units themselves were flexible networks that changed and shift. They could be a subordinate in one role. They could be a superior in another role. They could be a customer. They could be an equal competitor. They were small groups of networks, extended networks that operated and grew without replicating and without that centralized control. And it was infinitely malleable. That was the credit card industry. The credit card industry was going to go under if they didn't figure out a new way to operate. Now, they didn't spread wealth because their job wasn't to spread wealth and to share wealth as widely as they could. They shared credit. But it shows it can be done. It shows that it is entirely possible to redesign our system so that the value is sustainability and the value is reaching the most needs for the most people. We know how to do this. That's an indigenous economy operating today.
That's so interesting. What credit card company was that?
It started with Visa. It was D-Hawk. D-Hawk was the man that designed it.
Yeah. We know about D-Hawk.
Yeah, okay. And you know, I mean, all my statistics would be really too old from when I went in and actually researched it, but they had like, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of miles of 274 countries, and I forget exactly how many billions of transactions that goes through that system now. It's now not as pure and equal as when D did it, and it's been tweaked, but it's that real... the coyote whispering in your ear to take power and control, take power and control. Mm-hmm. And that coyote needs to be brought under and controlled so that that other coyote whispering in our ear that there's a better life and that we're all connected needs to be heard a whole lot louder.
Yeah.
Rebecca, I wonder, you know, we've seen these kinds of economies be taken over by cultural norms of self-interest. You know, it's almost as though self-interest is an invasive species.
Yes, good way to put it.
And they kind of get occluded by this kind of more power-hungry or as you overcoming scarcity mindset. Do you have insights as to how we can claim back these more community-based economic systems, how these values can be transferred such that people aren't running around based on fear?
You know, I think a whole lot of those examples are in your guests. I think you guys are doing a huge service by bringing spotlights on some of these work that's being done that nobody else would be talking about. But I think there's two things. I think there's the tweaking that we can do around the edges in this, and that, for instance, socially responsible investing has a lot of promise. If we could get in there and begin changing the metrics, especially like under ESG, the environmental, social, and governance investing that's going on now, has already changed the sort of practice. It was such a practice, it was practically law, that you had to invest for the highest return. Well, that's so transactional and short-term that it's just not sustainable. And so if we're starting to look at sustaining our human life on this planet, we're going to have to start moving sustainability front and center. And there's many things that we got to quit doing, which is the constant growth, you know, and the short transaction. We got to get past a quarterly report on the market. So that there's some technical structural things that we could do, but it does come back to the basic consciousness. To do this at the scale we need to have an evolutionary step as human beings where we understand how profoundly related and connected we are to every single thing, and that this is a universal life form that we're part of, and we need to begin to understand our role in being a part of something bigger than ourselves. And how do we conduct ourselves, and how do we build societies? Every living nation, whether it's in the plant nation or the animal nation, has struggled with this, and they've done so much better than us. Like you said, that we're the one species that could disappear and everybody would be better off.
That's true. We have
to bring this back to our consciousness on our fundamental purpose for being here is being. You know, it's fascinating. The Hopis don't have any concept of past, present, future. They have manifested in manifesting. It's such a spiritual tie and such a spiritual position within all of their existence that it's manifested or manifesting. They don't break up these categories and think that those are the realities. And just take a moment and try to think without past, present, future. It's hard for a Westerner to do.
Yeah. It's tough, you know. I think it's even within our language.
Right. And it's interesting, the Navajo language is starting to slowly be adapted by the quantum physics, because they don't have a language to talk about the relationships they're seeing. And in Navajo, they got like, I don't know, I'm going to be off, I don't remember the statistic, but it's like some enormous amount, like 230,000 words for relationship. And we have, we're over, we're beneath, we're beside, we're 6 inches away, we're that's it. How poverty are we? Poverty stricken in our language to even capture these concepts. But I mean, I do bring it back to there's many things we could do in the economy right now that recognize that our goal should be meeting the most needs of the most people, not accumulation. You know, we need to rethink things like bank loans. Why do you only get a loan if you already got the money? Why don't we start looking at making loans to people who need the money? You know, I mean, it's just, it's an incentive. You've already accumulated. So that's your incentive, is we make it easier.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a high pile of accumulation there, we make it really hard to live on this planet.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of clear, I think, or becoming clearer and clearer, you know, that within that extraction economy, let's call it this way, because that's really what it is, like take the most out of Earth, make the most money, accumulate, et cetera, et cetera. It's no basis for a future. I think this is becoming clearer and clearer to more and more people, right? So I was wondering, you know, we are... going probably through this sort of shift, through a transition at the moment. And I think it's cracking everywhere. Yeah, within all of our systems are kind of cracking, and we are seeing climate change coming, and we're not just talking about it, we actually can see it wherever we travel now. And the rich will not just escape from this, because, you know, it's one planet. And I was wondering always, like, when this shift is, when we're going through this transition, when is the tipping point? You know, when can we how can I say this? How can it turn? How can it turn into what you basically just described in the past, which could be our future? Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't think I can answer your question. I can ask the same question, but I do think, I mean, what we're seeing now is such a manifestation of the white patriarchal, fear-based, control-driven mindset or paradigm. And
which doesn't actually no longer work for the whites any longer anymore. You know?
That's, I'm saying... I mean, there's a silver lining coming out of the 4 years that we've just spent. Not that there's a single blame in any of this, because if we'd all reached this consciousness, we wouldn't even be where we are right now. But we've been given an opportunity to see it for what it is. And there's so many people out there really rising to the occasion. And the youth, the millennials, are just blowing me away. I mean, they just... the ones I know are having serious conversations about their values, about consumerism, about what they want out of life. And I don't think that conversation was prevalent enough, whether it's in our schools, in our homes, in our churches. We need to have conversations about what does it mean to be alive, and what do you want to do with that gift? I mean, do you want to just have as many plastic things as you can from Kmart? or I don't even know if they exist anymore, Walmart? What is our purpose here? Traditional societies always had ceremony. We had ceremony because the fundamental question of what is our purpose on such a deep personal level of what is my purpose? You need ceremony. You need help in understanding that. To be brought back into collaboration with society, with community, to see your role within that is where we need to go. Mm-hmm. And I think we would rethink how we do what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it starts with a tipping point in that. I believe there is a tipping point. I've seen things that really encourage me. Like I said, the millennials are so much further ahead. I'm in my 70s. And the questions they're asking, and I went through the hippie period, but it didn't have the foundation they have in their questions now. And it didn't have the kind of real human practicalities within how am I going to live? And, you know, many of them are strapped with a student debt. Many of them are still living at home in an economy that's made no space for them. I mean, as a society, we've made no space for the youth and the young people coming along. We just have gone on in a very selfish, myopic way. And it's consciousness that will change that. And I do see it. I see it out there. I see it on some levels where people have to work to get the gadget right first. Social investing is a very interesting phenomenon. I'm seeing things come out of medical fields now where they're looking at health as an emergent property. Well, that means it's not making just one person healthy. That means we got to have everyone healthy in our community. People are starting to come to this collective in a way that is right now it's probably causing them more questions than answers, but they got to get there and they got to start asking these questions. So I think it's happening. I would turn to you with what you're doing and seeing, you know, I've been kind of isolated in the work I've been doing. I'm usually going way out into rural areas you've got a sort of a bird's eye view of this area, I think, and what's going on.
You know, it's true that you do feel that consciousness coming forth in language, in especially in the younger generation. And at the same time, you know, when we speak to more traditional economists or business people, even who will happen to have this same kind of sense that we can improve the world, still believe that there's always going to be someone. It really doesn't take many people to be self-interested in a context of a community to change the whole dynamic. And I think our first guest we ever had was Evelyn Lintner, who taught us about the security dilemma. You know, that one nation builds a wall because they're afraid, or acquires a weapon because they're afraid of the invasion of another nation. And then suddenly all of the nations have to build walls and acquire weapons because it's everyone's just afraid of, and there's no actual threat in place. And so this kind of web of trust diminishes very quickly. And the question really is, like, how do you create a prophylactic against that outlier so that integrity of community can stay in place?
One thing is, I think we need to strip away the magic around economics. I think it's sort of our last sacred cow where they drag it off here and they say, well, we've got to do this because it's good for the economy. The economy is supposed to be good for us. We're not supposed to be good for the economy. The economy is supposed to be good for us. And so we have to start looking at this. Let me use an example. Like, everybody know, like you said, there's always some people that are going to be selfish. There's always some people that are going to have hot tempers. There's always people that are going to shoplift, but that doesn't mean the store's never open then. They account for a percentage. You kind of know in human nature, somebody's always going to be stealing, or you create an economy and a society where those are not incentivized. What we've done is we've put incentives around all the wrong behavior. I mean, you'd steal a bunch of money, kill somebody, go to jail, and write a book and make more money, and they make a movie of it. You know, I mean, they are continually rewarding the wrong behavior, both systematically and through the media, through there's a celebrityness now that I don't understand at all. I mean, how do you get famous doing nothing? But we have to come back to putting our values and knowing our values and living our values and looking at this economy for what it says about our values. We are very willing to let hundreds of thousands of people die for the economy right now. This is not the way the economy is supposed to work. You don't let people just die of a pandemic because you want to get the jobs back up. You can't. I mean, this is the most fundamentally illogical, stupid argument, and I can't understand how people just go along with it. Like, it's an either or. We either have an economy or you live. That, you know, think about that. It doesn't go together. It's suicidal at the very best. Yeah. So we have to start this quitting the either or and begin looking at what do we care about the most? Mm-hmm. What do we care about the most? Can we really say we care about the people the most? Mm-hmm. If we say that, then let's start designing our systems for that. Because we have a system that's been designed on the cost of war. The mm-hmm. whole GDP was formulated trying to figure out how much the wars cost Britain. And we operate off of a system then that values war and counts and measures for war, not for life. Mm-hmm. These things have to be changed, but they need to be called out first.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like what we really need is to figure out how to make connectivity and well-being for all as contagious as fear yes. is.
Yes, that's perfect. That's a perfect way to say it.
Rebecca, is there anything we should have asked you and we haven't asked you?
That's a good question. So, I would just give another plug for my cartoon. Yes. It really does help. It's on YouTube, Enough. When I put it up, it was the only thing called Enoughness, but now there's quite a few things about Enoughness. Look for the First Peoples Worldwide. It's not talking heads. It's an animated 4 minutes.
Really great. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
I hope we come together again, however that is.
Thank you.
Wow, she is a ball of fire, isn't she? I love how she talks about having our economy reflect our values as opposed to the other way around. Or the economy serves us. We don't serve the economy. And the economy should be based on our values. And it's easy to say, but not necessarily easy to implement. How could we do that?
Well, she gives us a clear pathway. And I think that's really interesting how she, because the concept is so also up for us upside down. This is not how our economy at the moment works, right? And for us, it's in a way, I think, conceptually pretty easy to understand. But and she gives us an example with the enoughness. And when you think of enoughness in our day, on our daily Western basis, what does it mean? We stand up, we get up, it's not enough. We hadn't have enough sleep, then we hadn't have enough coffee, then we hadn't had enough of that. In our economy, we never have enough. It's intrinsically built into our economic system.
Scarcity
is built in, and hence we never have enough. You can never have enough of money. It's part of our lives.
Yeah. But I think there's also something deeper going on here, and that is the conflict between individual interest or values and collective values. And, you know, you can have enoughness, which is sufficiency in the collective, but we, you know, this other model that we're living in is like not just not enoughness, but I need more.
Right. And she makes this example about the leaders, right? And which was very striking to me, sort of for Rebecca, a good leader is someone who gives most, gives back. And for us, I think our leaders, well, I don't want to refer to the last one we just had or just overcome, but it's like, how much can one accumulate?
Yeah.
And so it's always for her concept, it's, where the indigenous concept is like you take and you give back, and that's like a balance, or even give back more, you become a good leader.
Yeah, so my question really is, what does it take for each individual to internalize the value of the greater good? And I think that's really an important step in this concept. What is it going to take for us to create a society where everyone has this internal value that everyone should be okay.
I think we just got a bit of a glimpse of it in 2020, you know, where a lack of community, it basically means isolation. And a lot of people have experienced that. And what, you know, what isolation can do to your body, to your senses, to your life.
Yeah.
And the community, if you have community, you are so much better off.
I mean, one of the things she mentioned was this notion of ceremony and the fact that it would take a whole community to practice these ceremonies of connection to nature, connection to each other. And maybe that's what we need to bring back in order to kind of reorient ourselves to collective well-being as opposed to individual self-interest. What do you think?
I think we this is quite a different mindset, Mel. You know, we're talking about quite a mind shift, which I'm not saying we can't shift. I mean, it would be fantastic if Rebecca would become part of the Biden team, you know, 20th of January. I would, if I were Biden, I would just, hey, give her a call and make her part of the team. No, I'm serious. You know, I think we should have more indigenous thinking in the new administration because we are going to have a new year. And when I hear, like, how do we build our economy back, it's like, okay, no, let's not just build it back. Like, it's not about building it back, it's about building it better.
Yeah.
And better for absolutely all of us. Yeah. And I guess, I mean, for me, a lot of the concepts Rebecca is talking about could be, you know, real bricks in that new kind of better economy maybe a Biden administration is aiming for.
Absolutely. I think, yeah. I mean, I think there's so many layers of possibility here. And I guess for me, it is how we all become mindful about these collective values. And we do it in education, we do it in ceremony, we might do it in a paradigm of giving. All of these are things that we need to work on. And, you know, and the indigenous cultures have given us a roadmap, right? And so maybe we can just start applying these things more often and in more contexts.
I would rely on the government, though.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.